Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. And welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at EPFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Robert Dessal, the co-author of Natural History of Color, the science behind what we see and how we see it. Is color a phenomenon of science or a thing of art? Over the years, color has dazzled, enhanced, and clarified the world we see, embraced through the experimental palettes of painting, the advent of the color photograph, technicolor pictures, color printing, on and on, a vivid and vibrant celebrated continuum. These turns to represent reality in living color, echo of our evolutionary reliance on, and indeed privileging of color as a complex and vital form of consumption, classification, and creation. It's everywhere we look, yet do we really know much of anything about it? Finding color in stars and light, examining the systems of classification that determine survival through natural selection, studying the arrival of color in our universe, and as a fulcrum for philosophy, Dessal's brilliant Natural History of Color book establishes that an understanding of color on many different levels is at the heart of learning about nature, neurobiology, individualism, even a philosophy of existence. Color and a fine-tuned understanding of it is vital to our understanding ourselves and our consciousness. Well, Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
It's great. Really nice to have you here. So I'm going to start by asking you, well, as we're living through these really unprecedented times of the global pandemic, how has it impacted you and your work?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Since I worked on viruses as part of my research program, the research has caught up, kind of sped up a lot. And so understanding what I know about viruses and how coronavirus works has been very helpful for a couple of reasons. One, my students at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City work on all kinds of things, but as I said, they work on viruses too, and it's affected their work. Secondly, it's affected my interaction with the exhibitions and communications team at the museum. Because I'm kind of the person who has the handle on viruses, I've been asked to do a lot of public education and public outreach over the last 8 months, 9 months, a lot more than I usually do. So it's affected my work in a pretty big way in those contexts. But otherwise, working from home is not so bad. And I do miss the sounds of children in the halls of the museum. The museum's been closed and at very, very low capacity for visitors for the last 6 months. So, but I do miss the sounds and the the excitement of all the kids running through the museum. That'll come back.
The face-to-face interactions?
Yeah, and just the sounds of kids' voices in the museum, and you know, the sounds of kids having fun and running around. So the face-to-face interaction with my colleagues, I miss that a lot. Like I say, I think we're gonna be back in good shape soon.
Mm. Yeah, it's a really interesting point you raise about the sounds. Thinking about museums, they create this sort of atmosphere, don't they? Especially the big spaces, you can hear from very far.
Yeah, it's wonderful. The galleries were built to be kind of sound studios. and so you oftentimes can hear from one end of a gallery to another, and as you pointed out, from gallery to gallery. And unfortunately now, the excitement that you would hear if there were a bunch of kids in the museum, you know, running around the dinosaur halls or the Hall of African Mammals, or even the show that I curated that we're going to talk about here and the book, there's lots of sounds that you hear. And it's kind of eerie. Not to hear those sounds as someone who's been at the museum. I've been at the museum for 30 years now, and it's kind of eerie not to hear all those sounds that you usually hear when you walk in through the door.
Yeah, hopefully we will return back to normal state of affairs soon.
Mm.
So shall we start with a little bit about yourself? So can you tell us a bit more about your biography and how you got interested in molecular biology, genomics, and then how you became a museum curator?
Yeah. I started out as a fruit fly biologist, as a fruit fly geneticist, crossing flies and trying to understand the genetics of one species. And I moved on from those flies to another group of flies that live in Hawaii. They're a beautiful assemblage of flies that have just exploded with diversity and speciation. And so there's hundreds of species there, whereas across the rest of the world, there's an equal number of species. So half the species on the planet of this group are in Hawaii. And that interest then led to interest in naming things and interest in understanding how things are related to each other. And I was very lucky to get a curatorial position at the American Museum of Natural History in 1990. So, like I said, I've been at the museum for 30 years. Molecular biologists at the American Museum is kind of odd, though, because we look at specimens and we try to understand the whole organism. But the provost of the museum back then had the insight to realize that genetics and how genes are related to each other via the organisms would be an important part of museum science. And over the last 30 years, as I pointed out earlier, I've worked on everything from whales to viruses and had just a blast doing it, mostly because I get to interact with a lot of students and they're really smart people. To learn from them about their interests and to be able to contribute to their work has been a real privilege during my career.
Were you always interested in the science communication? Because you started it really, really early before it actually has become the field itself, hasn't it?
Yeah, so you know, I always really, really loved Stephen Jay Gould's writing and always really, although he's a very easy person to disagree with on a lot of subjects, his writing and his way of communicating was just amazing. And I had the pleasure of taking over teaching in one of his courses toward the end of his life when he was teaching at NYU. He'd also taught at Harvard, of course, but he was doing lectures at NYU, and I had the pleasure of taking over his lectures and the pleasure of interacting with him and figuring out how to do that takeover. So,
oh wow,
his work, his writing, I think, really had a huge impact on me and the desire to, or at least the awakening to communicate science. there's a lot of people who want to do communication in science, and I feel very lucky because I think the stars were in alignment, the planets were in alignment for me to really get a good chance to do communication as a curator at the museum. And it turned out that luckily, or I don't know, just serendipitously, you know, genetics and genomics became a big thing at the turn of the century. And myself, along with one other curator, we were the molecular biologists at the museum. So every time a non-organismal topic arose, like genomics or infectious disease or neurobiology microbiology, anytime these subjects arose as topics for a major exhibition, I got tapped on the shoulder for it, which was a real privilege and a real honor to be able to put these shows together at the museum, and to also try to communicate via writing, and mostly via book writing. It's a kind of a serendipitous pathway to this, but kind of an inevitable one if you're get a job at a museum like the American Museum.
Were there other mentors that were inspirational to you, perhaps?
Sure. My PhD advisor, Alan Templeton, who's a famous fly biologist, and my postdoc advisor, Alan Wilson, who's widely considered the father of modern molecular evolution, were big influences to me. And then there's a geneticist at Harvard University who is my postdoctoral advisor also, Dan Hartle, who's a really wonderful person and an amazing geneticist. So I had a pretty good background and a pretty good bunch of people kind of pushing me in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any advice to our young and early career academic listeners, perhaps, with the choice of the path
they want to follow? You know, when I was a young one, I wanted to work on narwhals. Narwhals are these really beautiful cetaceans that live in the Arctic that have these huge elongated teeth that look like a spear coming out of their nose. And I wanted to work on those because I just thought they were pretty cool. And I went to talk to one of my advisors, and my advisor said, try to learn some genetics, or, you know, try to learn some physiology, and then come back to the narwhals. And that's exactly what happened. I went out and I learned the genetics, and I didn't come back to narwhals, but I ended up working on whales, on humpback whales and on porpoises and other cetaceans. So the advice that I got for that was very good. And you know, I think the advice was kind of two-headed. One was, yeah, you need to learn the genetics. You need to learn something about the biology of organisms in order to specialize in one. But the other was just be patient, you know, learn as much as you can. And then when you have a good idea about something, about a system, about a group of animals like narwhals, or like humpback whales or papillomaviruses, you know, when you have a good idea about any of these things, then you're really well prepared to approach them. So, you know, more or less just expand your horizons and be patient.
That is such a crucial advice. And I'm really glad that you mentioned it, that going into detail as well. It's so important. Yeah,
you know, there's been a big backlash over the last three or four decades because genomics and genetics has kind of taken over. Almost everything uses genomics and genetics. And this whole idea of reductionism, of reducing things down to genes, is a bad thing. You know, it's not good to do that and not know your organisms. But in order to know your organisms, you oftentimes have to know how its genes work or how its physiology works or how its neurobiology works. So you have to really be expansive in the way you think about things and patient in the way you use them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so now you're a curator at the Museum of Natural History. And we have mentioned a bit of ambience in the museum where you have the sounds. But now we're going to switch to the topic of the color, which is indeed the topic of your recent book. So can you tell us, how did you come to writing this book?
Yeah, a lot of times when someone writes a book, they don't know they're going to write it. And they're more or less led by the ear, by the nose to write the book. And my work here at the museum led to the people here at the museum realizing that I could communicate science about molecular, non-organismal based things. And about 4 years ago at the museum, we did a show on the senses. And 3 years before that, we did a show on the brain. And so we have at the Natural History Museum focused on neurobiology and how organisms sense the world around them. That's the closest tie to neurobiology that natural history has. You know, how do we as organisms sense the world around us? And so at one point during the development of the senses show, which touched on all of the major so-called Aristotelian senses, we realized that color was a really, really neat idea and neat topic. And so 3 years after the senses exhibition, we decided to do a color show. And usually the way that the development of an exhibition goes, at least at the American Museum, is the curator of the show develops the narrative and develops the main outline for the show. And then the writers in the exhibition department tear it up and throw it away and go ahead and do what they want. But they need to know.
Yeah.
No, it's a really great process, actually. And they need to know where the scientific mind is when putting a show together. And they get that from the scientists. And in the process of putting that together, the curator, at least for me, I always end up with a great outline for a book. And so, the book kind of flows from the outline that I delivered to the exhibitions department to put the show together. And there are a lot of similarities between the book and the show. And as a reader of the book would notice, we've actually even put photographs from the show in the book, and attempted to integrate the photographs from the show into the narrative of the book. You know, I'm sorry, I can't say that it comes from this burning, blazing, interesting color, but it does come from a real interest and desire to educate the general public about about a scientific topic that's really, really important in natural history.
And this really comes through in a book, the clear and engaging communication of these really sort of difficult topics for people. So that's what makes this book really stand out, because the color, as you mentioned, it's visual. It's not something that you generally describe, is it?
Yeah, no, it's something that touches on every aspect of natural history. I, you know, when we do a dinosaur exhibit, well, you know, maybe paleontology is the subject that's touched upon by the show, but color, it touches on astronomy, geology, physics. It touches on organismal biology, like invertebrate biology, and anthropology has a huge contextual role in understanding color. So every department in the American Museum was interested in the show. And every department was interested in how the book was developed, because their major focus in those other departments had something to do with color. And I knew that when we decided to do it, I knew that we had to bridge all the way from the Big Bang, all the way from matter being created and then photons being created and all of this other really interesting stuff that happens in the cosmological world, to people's behaviors and beliefs, et cetera, and how we we perceive and interpret color in modern society, and then everything in between, which makes color just an amazing topic, even to the point of challenging and going outside of natural history, even to the point of challenging what it means to exist, even to challenge what it means to perceive and to know that you're existing. Color is an amazingly neat topic to think about, those kinds of things that probably you thought about when you were an undergrad in college, sitting up late at night, so thinking about your existence and that. So just a broad range of things that we could do here, and a broad range of things that I tried to bring into the book.
Yes, exactly. And as you mentioned, colors is such a salient, sort of visceral topic for a visual animal like human, who relies on their vision. So can you tell us, why is it difficult to define, and is it really easily understandable concept?
You know, like I say, color has been used by philosophers for, I don't know, maybe 500 years, maybe even longer than that, to open up a way to think about existence and a way to think about, I think, therefore I am kinds of things. And that's because physically, color is a physical phenomenon. Color is of course, the perception of wavelengths by organisms and by, machines, whatever. It's a physical thing, but because it's so ingrained in the way that we as humans think about it, and it's so ingrained in the way we interpret the world around us, it has so many ways that it can be viewed by people that it just opens up all kinds of different ways of thinking. For instance, there's several places where color can differ between you and I. For instance, we're looking at a light of a particular wavelength, and I ask you, what are you seeing? And you say, I'm seeing green. And I'll say, yeah, I'm seeing green too. But the overall question is that green that you're seeing the same green that I'm seeing? Of course, we get in the ballpark with the physical stuff, but once the signals get transmitted to our brains, then there is a lot of really neat things that happen. Memory kicks in. Your cultural attitudes kick in. Your emotions kick in. All kinds of things will become involved, and in the way you're perceiving and interpreting the color, that it's almost certain that the green that you might see from me, the very same source of light, is not the same green that I'm seeing. So, at a physical level, it's got to be the same, but at a emotional, cultural level, it's going to be very different.
And that's a really excellent point you put across in the book so clearly, that the color can be defined at different levels through physics, and then going to human physiology and psychology and philosophy and anthropology.
Yeah, so there's a lot. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just wondering how the definition of color between these sort of disciplines differs and complements our understanding of it.
That's a really cool question. I think physically, the definitions of color are pretty straightforward. You can get a machine to tell you what color a source of light is because mm-hmm. it can measure a wavelength. And that wavelength then is, you use a set of definitions to determine what color it is. As I said earlier, that particular color, when it gets kind of incorporated into your thinking, into your brain, then gets interpreted in many, many different ways. And so the definition of color at the physical level is, I would say, pretty straightforward, but at the emotional, cultural level, it becomes really, really complex. And that's because at the physical level, we have evolved to perceive color in a particular physical way. We have evolved to use the rod and cone cells of our eyes to capture light waves and then to send a signal to our brain saying it's this particular light wave, and then we associate that with the color. And that evolutionary process is very, very strong and very, very hard, and took a very, very long time to set. On the other hand, our cultural notion of color comes through what we commonly know as cultural evolution. Our cultural perception of what red means, or our cultural perception of what blue means, comes through cultural evolution. And cultural evolution is much, much faster than physical evolution of genes and populations. And that's because cultural evolution is not transmitted by genes. It's transmitted more by ideas and by the way we communicate with each other. So there's no wonder that the cultural context of color and the physical context of color are really different from each other. They're evolving under completely different pressures, with completely different end products, completely different forces driving them in the natural world around us.
It's actually following up on this. So perhaps this would be a bit of a silly question, but still I'm going to ask it. So what about the transition in between colors? So for example, if you go from orange to red, how do you cross that line where there's orange and when there's red? And maybe there's a cultural differences in that?
Yeah, that's one of the arguments that a lot of philosophers used to challenge the reality of color. And that's because, for a couple of reasons. One is that physically, again, if we used a machine to measure wavelengths, we'd know exactly, if we had a definition of what the wavelengths meant, then we'd know exactly where the transition happened. But because, at least let's talk about humans and comparing how they react to that transition. Some humans will have opsins, which are the proteins that are in your rods and cones that detect light, will have particular kinds of opsins, and other humans won't. And so physically, at the very beginning, you could have a difference in how a human might perceive a color transition. But then once the information gets to the brain, as I said earlier, it becomes much, much more complex, and your capacity to make sense of that transition, or to actually say, oh, it changed right there, it's diminished because we don't use those hard definitions that, say, a machine would use to count the wavelengths as they're going from one major kind of color to another.
It's really, really interesting. And yes, as you said, it's really a philosophy part of it.
Yeah, no.
Sorry.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to say that, and it is something that we should probably be thinking about as an example of how different cultures perceive different things. Now, you would not say that there's a gene involved in the perception of red in the Middle East and in Indian cultures versus red in Western cultures. There's a difference. There's a big difference in how people in those two geographic areas perceive red and interpret red, more in how they interpret red and more in what red means to them But you would never say that that's a genetic difference. That's a cultural difference. And those cultural differences are becoming more and more important in understanding our differences as humans across the globe. And I think color can be a good example to people thinking about this kind of thing, you know, thinking about how different cultures approach different things is an important subject, an important way of thinking about the world in these times. And again, we have a perfect example of how culture affects things in color. There's other things like music and other things that could be used too, but color is probably a really important one to keep in mind when we're thinking about cultural differences.
And historically, does the availability of color differ between cultures? So, for example, dyes that are present?
Yeah, that's a great question too. Up until recently, I mean within the last millennium, humans could only reproduce a certain range of colors through dyes and through stains and things like that, through ochres and charcoal for black, and the color range was very limited. And then as science progressed in the Renaissance, and humans spanned the globe in exploration and in conquest, colors started to get more and more diverse. So one of my favorite examples is the importation of the deep red color from Cochinella beetles that are found in South America. That particular color and the availability of it to humans in Europe was unknown. And the Spanish brought back this technology of making this red dye from Cochinella beetles, so grinding them up and making a red dye from it. And red became a very important color in European culture. Same thing with indigo, indigo dyes from the East. And this development of more and more colors for people to work with is a very recent one. And you now have palettes of color names for all these colors, and it's a broad, much, much broader range of colors that humans deal with now than I think they did even half a millennium ago.
This absolutely fascinating subject where the science really goes together with the culture, that the development of chemical methods to produce color, it really impacted the lives of people every day, what they see, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's actually gone a step further, I think, in how I'm looking at my computer screen and I'm seeing colors on my computer screen and how those colors are produced. So I've got a big red dot in the upper left-hand corner. I think you might have one on your screen too, because we're using the same program. But that red dot is not the same as a red dot that you might see on a painting. And that's because the red dot on your screen is created by pixelation. And a pixel, at least the red dots on our computer screens, are a combination of red, green, and blue colors. And each pixel has a switch for those three colors. And that red is actually not red. It's a combination of red, blue, and green in some way. So we even have gotten to that point where the colors we see are not really the same colors as we might have seen 100 years ago without a computer screen.
This is absolutely fascinating when you think about it, that every red that you see every day, it's not exactly the same red.
Sure. And the best way to drive that home is to take your computer to a museum, find a Kandinsky painting, and look at a yellow or a blue or a red in a Kandinsky painting.
I'm just going to look at my wall. I've got one right here, composition.
Okay. Look at it on the wall. If it's a painting, if Kandinsky did it, that red ball or that red stick that he drew is not going to be the same as the red that you would see in the reproduction of the painting on your computer screen. It's different. It's physically different. So, and there's a case where it's actually physically different and not just different because your mind has processed some information differently than the way someone else would.
Okay, so let's maybe flip our perspective a little bit. So what about the lack of color? So black and white, thinking about the early 19th century movies, for example. Mm-hmm. So is there any significance and how can you draw parallels?
The lack of color is something that psychologists have studied and it's one of perception. And of course, there are a lot of people on the planet who cannot see colors and they do perfectly well with their lives. These are people who are dichromatic individuals. They, instead of having three ways of viewing, of categorizing light waves in their rods and cones, they only have two. And there are even monochromatic individuals who only see things in one shade. And the capacity to survive in black and white is fine. And in fact, most of the mammals on this planet are dichromatic. Most of the mammals on this planet see things in black and white. It's only when you get to primates that there's a widespread trichromatic way of viewing color. So the organisms can survive. Just to go back to the very basic aspect of this, organisms with dichromatic color vision can survive, but do they have the same richness of life, et cetera, et cetera? Well, maybe they do, maybe they don't. It's difficult to say, again getting back to more of a philosophical question of are the black and white shades that we see in a classic black and white movie giving us the same information as and the same feeling as a fully colored one. I can point to a very recent example in pop culture where this happens. There have been several recent movies produced in black and white that are absolutely stunning in black and white. One is a Spanish version of Snow White. I'm forgetting the name of it, but it's absolutely beautiful in black and white. And if it was in color, it probably would have been a completely different movie. And then another really interesting pop mention or a pop reference would be The Walking Dead, the television series about zombies when the first this was the third episode of the first season was first aired. It was aired in color, and it's perhaps one of the bloodiest, grossest colored episodes in television history. And just recently they started to rebroadcast it in black and white. And it's as terrifying, if not more terrifying, in black and white than it was in color. Because it essentially leaves your imagination to what is red or bloody or whatever. Whereas the explicit coloring of the original version was leading you to think, oh, there's tons of blood there. But I found it much more terrifying than the original color version. So black and white, you can communicate with it. You can survive in black and white. You can actually have wonderful experiences in black and white. And, you know, in fact, as I said, there are people who live on this planet who live in a very dichromatic kind of a world where the colors that we folks who do have color vision, they live in a completely different colored world, but they probably perceive it in very much the same way we do.
It's really, really interesting. So what about the super perceptors? Something like mantis shrimp, for example, that has a huge range of colors that you can see.
Yeah, so to go back and get a little bit more into the science of color vision, I spoke of rods and cones, and these are cells in the retina of your eye. The retina is your retina, and your eye is at the back of your eye, and it's a field of millions of cells. And each of those cells has a protein in it called an opsin. And these opsins are tuned genetically and by their structure to detect light of a certain wavelength. And then they're connected by a nerve system to your brain. So if a light of a particular wavelength hits an opsin that will react to it, then it sends a message to your brain and says, in that spot in my field of vision, there's something that's red, or there's something that's green, or something that's blue. And that's how the opsins work. And so as I intimated just a second ago, there's ways that you can increase your color vision by increasing the number of opsins. So that's what happened in the evolution of primates and in the evolution of other organisms on the planet. The number of opsins that are in our genome and in the genomes of some primates allow for three colors to be detected, colors, red, green, and blue, to be detected. In a dichromatic individual, there's only two that are detected. Now, in some cases in humans, there'll be four kinds of opsins in the retina. And these will detect four kinds of colors. And these are called tetrachromatic individuals. Their vision is supposed to be much richer and much sharper than with respect to colors than even a trichromatic is. Now, you mentioned this mantid shrimp. Some mantid shrimps have 13 to 18 of these opsins. And we aren't quite sure what these opsins do or what it allows these organisms to do with respect to color vision. But they do have this range of opsins that collect light at wavelengths that are outside of our range of collecting color wavelengths. So we only have a very narrow range of wavelengths of light that our eyes detect, actually even just detect. Once you go below 300 nanometers wavelength, that's a really, really tiny wavelength of a light. And once you go above 700, we don't see those things because we simply don't have the mechanics or the mechanisms in our eyes to detect those wavelengths. Now, there are organisms like mantid shrimps, or let's think more about say butterflies and other insects with wider ranging opsins. They can see into the ultraviolet, and so they can see patterns in ultraviolet color that we simply cannot see. It's kind of like a dog being able to hear in a range of sound waves that we simply can't hear. So and this, again, these mantid shrimps are spectacular in their number of opsins, and more than likely have these opsins as a result of some selection on their genome to maintain this large number of broad ranging opsins. There's another I talked about the ultraviolet end and organisms like butterflies and things like that, moths and butterflies, to see in the ultraviolet range. Some organisms can actually see in the infrared range. And we can, as humans, we can see a little bit into the infrared range, a little bit more than we used to think we could. But there are organisms who can see the infrared range absolutely clearly. And I use the word see as kind of a placeholder for what they're actually doing. They're actually detecting wavelengths of light that emanate because of heat from things. And these are the heat vision or night vision kinds of things that we see in the popular media. And snakes, pit vipers especially, are quite good at seeing into this range. But the thing I'm trying to point out is that it's a stretch to call it seeing, because they're not using their eyes to process that information. They're using a sensor in a pit, which is why they're called pit vipers, a sensor in the pit that detects the infrared wavelengths. And that interacts with the visual system of the snake to tell the snake something about what's around it. So we have all kinds of interesting variations and interesting ranges across which organisms can see colors on this planet. And we're a pretty atypical species on this planet with respect to color vision, because we can see 3 different colors, sometimes 4. Most of the organisms on the planet, well, at least most mammals on the planet, view the world dichromatically.
And this loops back to the beginning of our conversation of what actually color is, right? So it's just a tiny, tiny part of the electromagnetic spectrum, is it?
Yes, and you know, let's go back to that pit viper. Is that a color? If the pit viper decided to use something in its nose to in its nasal cavity to detect infrared, would that be called seeing color? But the thing that makes it color or seeing to the snake is that it's integrated with its normal color vision in its eyes. So in that sense, it is seeing. But in some other senses, it's some other in some other ways, it's yet another sense.
Interesting. So perhaps it's down to sort of classification, really, of what we classify, as you said, either as a sense or a color, as that is.
Yeah, that's an interesting one too, because now you can say, well, my sense of sight is actually not a single sense. It's actually 3 senses. I can sense green, I can sense red, I can sense blue. And it's all a matter of how you define things and how you allow things to be broken down in your way of defining things.
And that, again, it touches something beyond the physics, right? So how we perceive it, how we sense it.
Way beyond. And again, it's used by philosophers to understand consciousness, to at least talk about consciousness. I mean, talking about consciousness in a philosophical, biological way is really difficult. And, you know, color is one of these things that researchers have used as a foothold into thinking about it.
Especially that sometimes it's possible to see, well, air quotes, the color, even when it's not present.
That's right. And those are very interesting. I don't know if you're referring to color illusions any kind of optical illusion is a version of that.
And also synesthesia as well. It's experience of color, which is not there really.
That's one thing I didn't really go into in any detail in the book. And so anybody who's looking for it will more than likely be disappointed. But we do, I do touch upon it briefly. And it is a fascinating topic, synesthesia. But it's a bit different than perceiving a light wave as something as a different color than what somebody else. Synesthesia is essentially perceiving a light wave, one version of it is perceiving a light wave and smelling something. So It's even more extreme of an example of how our nervous systems perceive things and then interpret things. So it's a little bit different, but still a fascinating topic.
Yes, absolutely. It's a really, really deep topic. So can we just sort of bring it a little bit to home, the color itself? So now we see that color is really integral in our experience of the world and so deeply ingrained in our cultures. Mm-hmm. So how can we use color to improve our well-beings, especially during the times of confinement, for example? Can we somehow manipulate our surroundings? And
There's a lot of research that's been done recently on color and mood and color and emotional well-being. And there are certain colors that are almost directly tied to different kinds of moods. One of the elements of the show that we did in New York City was a game show that visitors interact with. And if you're worried about interacting with a computer screen, we've thought about that, and you use your smartphone to do the interaction within the exhibition. It's quite clever. And so we do surveys of people, and you know, we'll play some music, some somber music, some somber Beethoven or something like that, and show them a palette of colors and have them pick a color that describes their mood. And inevitably, a darkish blue, brown, black is chosen over a red, yellow, green. And this is because the mood that is kind of stimulated by the music is a blue mood. You can also ask, string together a string of happy words, and the colors red, the colors of yellow and bright colors are chosen as the color that describes your mood. And in fact, as a reader of the book might notice, the galleries in the show are color themed. And I always remark when I walk through the show that when I go from the indigo part of the show, where we show how indigo dyes are made and how they've been very important in cultures, you step out and you walk into the red room, which is all about how red has influenced our cultures, and your complete I think your physiology even changes, and when you step into the red room, you get more excited, you're more tense. So the colors have a big effect, and in fact, these experiments that are done are measure excitement and measure tension and measure other kinds of things when you see colors changing, or when you go from, say, a blue environment to a red environment. And in just to kind of bring it back together, we probably could think more about how we're using color when we're conveying information. And neuroeconomists do this all the time. A neuroeconomist is someone who uses the study of psychology and neurobiology to impact economics, to impact selling things. And in fact, neuroeconomists know that to use certain colors with certain products. So a little known thing is that if you have a bottle of wine with a very colorful label on it, or a bottle of wine with a dark label with black lettering on it, that the wine that the person is going to choose, if the person is offered those two wines and it's the same exact wine, they're going to choose the one with the dull black label and not the colorful label, because our psychologies don't associate colorfulness with good wine, and we instead associate these somber colors and serious looking colors with a serious wine. So there's lots of instances of that where neuroeconomists have studied those behaviors and influenced the way that a product gets marketed. And I don't see any reason why people who are thinking about human well-being in these troubled times wouldn't be able to use some of the neuroeconomic principles that individuals use to sell things. They could probably use these principles and these ways of thinking about things to make things better for us. So, the color has a huge impact on our psyche and on our emotional well-being, certainly.
That's really, really interesting, the neuroeconomics part of it. So just to round up our discussion, I'd like to ask perhaps the most obvious but complex and crucial question. And after researching this topic in depth, to you personally, what is the color?
There's a great scene in Monty Python's The Holy Grail where one of the ogres asks the guys what their favorite color is, and if they get it wrong, they shoot up into the air and blow up. And so I'm afraid.
Oh, dear.
I'm afraid to say red, green, blue, yellow. I don't know. I have my favorite color from childhood, which is blue. But I'm afraid that has been kind of forced on me. I think culturally, boys who grew up in the 50s, 60s, and 70s were associated with the color blue, and girls with the color pink, and still in many ways that goes on. Which is unfortunate, because maybe if I hadn't been kind of pre-tuned to blue, I might like something like a pink. I might wear a pink tuxedo, you know. Sorry about that. I might like pink. I might like to put on a pink tuxedo every once in a while. But I think that if you step back and try to figure out what your favorite color is, you're doing something really, really complex and something really, really interesting, because you're trying to process what your brain thinks are colors with something emotional going on in your mind. And unless you've got a pretty open road to that, you're probably going to go along with what your culture or with what you've been raised to look at as a favorite color. I don't know if that's what you're asking me about, favorite color, but my favorite thing to see in all of the stuff that happens in nature is a rainbow, which of course has all the colors in it and some. So, maybe it's the better answer to that is lots of colors, instead of just one particular color.
Yes, exactly. And that's that was what I meant. And especially the strength of this book is that it makes you think in depth, what is color to you and how can you redefine it, knowing all of these connotations, excuse me, the cultural, physical, physiological.
Yeah, I think that's...
Okay,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go on.
I was just going to say, I think that's really, you hit the nail on the head. What I wanted people to come away with from the book is a better understanding of what color is, because color is something we interact with every day, and color is something we interact with almost every minute of the day that our eyes are open. So I wanted people to really get the sense of how wonderful nature is and how wonderful nature has been in molding the way that we view color on the planet.
Okay, so we've taken up a lot of your time. So can I ask, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a new book with my colleague Ian Tattersall, who's an anthropologist, in a series of understand. It's called Understanding Blank, and we're writing this book on understanding race and racial concepts. So it's a interesting topic, and one that I that Ian and I have written a lot about. And I think equally important in these times also.
Yeah, exactly. It's really timely project, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially with all of the leaning back, in my opinion, in the wrong direction, more toward racism, more toward explaining our behaviors with race is such a bad thing to do. And I hope this book with Ian actually helps a lot of people think more clearly about themselves and more clearly about their relationships with other people.
Sounds like a really exciting project. So what would you like our listeners to take home with them? So do you have a...
Well, like I said, I think that I didn't, when I started this project, I didn't think it would really be that expansive. And what I didn't realize is that how much we rely on color for a lot of things, all the way from understanding the evolution of the universe to understanding evolution on our planet, to understanding culture on our planet, to understanding our behaviors. And I just would hope that anybody who reads the book comes away with a better feel for color, not a complete feel for color, but a better feel for how complex it is and how much it really means to us as an organism here on this planet.
And where can our listeners find more information about the book and your work?
I believe it's widely available on Amazon, but it's also you could also find it on our website at the American Museum of Natural History. And you can find information on the color show on our website at the American Museum of Natural History. You know, hopefully in the next 6 months, we'll be getting back to full open. And at that point in time, the show will be up for another year, year and a half. So everyone's got a lot of time to see the show and, to prepare for it. You might want to pick up the book.
Excellent. So hopefully, yeah, we will be back to a state of normalcy soon.
Good.
Okay, so thank you so much for joining me today. That was a really fascinating discussion, and I'm really hoping our listeners enjoy reading the book.
My pleasure, Galena.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much.